What does it mean to be a man in 2018?
What does a man do?
What is it to be a man?
The notion of what a man should be like.
It's very confusing.
Be a man.
It's not quite what you think it is.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type?
In order to be a man, they've got to separate their hearts from their heads.
There's a part of them crying out for the incorporation of the monster within them.
What is best in life? To crush your enemies and to hear the lamentation of your women.
Most of the violent crimes that happen are not committed by women, committed by men.
What does it mean to be a man?
It ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Men, you have work to do.
How do you define masculinity? I'm Tanzina Vega, and on this special episode of the Takeaway Podcast, we're going to hear from lots of people who've thought quite a bit about masculinity, starting with you.
To be a man in 2018 is somewhat difficult.
The definition of masculinity is changing.
It took me a long time to figure out what it meant to be a man because I found my father to be very overbearing.
Men are oftentimes told to suck it up. It is what it is. You know, we're supposed to deal, but, you know, how do you deal?
I still need to shoot a bow and arrow every once in a while.
I'm one of those guys that likes to open a door for a person I don't even know.
We're often criticized for the very things that make us men.
My quiet personality tends to get mistaken for the macho, tough guy kind of cowboy attitude.
I'm a big dude. I wear pink sunglasses, pink shoes, and occasionally don't mind dressing up in leggings and a dress.
Traditional definitions no longer capture all of masculinity.
Cherry was right. You're soft. You should have let him kill me, because I'm going to kill you.
For decades, American masculinity was often coupled with the idea of heroic John Wayne types who were decisive, strong, and of course, breadwinners. But today, that image is shifting. From the Me Too movement to mass shootings and mental health, many American men and women are trying to redefine what it means to be a man. But that vision of American masculinity is also turning dark quickly.
White supremacists, men's rights movement, father rights, angry white boys, the school shooters, men who are violent against women, incels. The thing that unites all of those different groups in terms of their vision is what I came to call aggrieved entitlement.
That's Dr. Michael Kimmel of Stony Brook University, and he's been studying men and masculinity for decades. Dr. Kimmel says that the anger expressed today by these different groups of men is the result of a specific mindset.
I bought into this system. You promised me that if I worked hard and I paid my taxes and I was a good man, that I would be able to reap the same rewards that my father and grandfather did, and that world's gone. Well, why would I have done that if you didn't promise me? So they feel betrayed.
We're starting to become more comfortable calling white male extremism by its name, but real solutions still feel hard to come by. And changing definitions about masculinity aren't just about white men either.
Black men, Latino men want the same kinds of power. They want to be at the kind of apex of the hierarchy in the same way as white men do in many communities. At the same time, they are also coping with the reality that they're often not.
That's Professor Pedro Noguera of UCLA.
We don't know what's going on in our society that has resulted in so many boys of color who are unsuccessful. Now, some of that is we can attribute to racism and bias, but there's more to it because racism would affect girls in the same ways. And I think a lot of it has to do with this ways in which masculinity, black masculinity, Latino masculinity, gets constructed and results in an undervaluing of education, of the kind of soft skills that many times women are acquiring, like how to work with people, and it places young men at a huge disadvantage.
Young men of color are being placed at a huge disadvantage, and Pedro Noguera says we have to be careful.
We don't want to see the same kind of angry backlash that we're seeing among some white males also show up amongst black and Latino males out of a sense of lost entitlement that then is taken out on women and girls.
And when it comes to masculinity today, Professor Noguera also thinks we need to look beyond the angry backlash.
We know that we're in a period of great flux around gender roles. Men today, in many families, are doing far more childcare than their fathers ever did. They're doing the dishes more. They're much more involved in the domestic life of families. They're doing it both because their partners insist upon it, but also because many of them want to be involved with their kids, want to be nurturers, and want to be providers in ways that go beyond a paycheck. And that suggests that the role of men is evolving. What we don't know is what's evolving too. And that's where I think critical discussion about men's roles in society, about what does it mean to be a man today, are very important. And we need to recognize that issues like race and class complicate the way we think about masculinity, because it means different things in different contexts.
I couldn't agree more at what Pedro just said. The other thing is that not only are we doing more housework and more childcare than ever before, and not only do we want to, but we're actually liking it. So anybody who comes along, as Jordan Peterson does, and says we should return to those traditional ways is unlikely to resonate with women at all. Because I don't think, Tanzina, I don't think that women, you, for example, are going to have some kind of V8 moment where you hit yourself upside the head and say, you know what, they were right. Let's stop voting. Let's stop working. Let's stop driving cars. Let's stop serving on juries. Let's stop having orgasms. I mean, that's not going to happen. So the question is not whether we are going to return to traditional roles. We are not going to, quote, make gender great again, unquote. What we are going to do is move into the future. And the future is far more egalitarian than the past. Because to underline what Pedro said, this is not simply normative. This is not simply what men should be doing. It's what men are doing. And it's what men feel motivated to be doing. That is the done deal. We are not going to go backward.
I'm speaking about masculinity with Professor Pedro Noguera of UCLA and Dr. Michael Kimmel of Stony Brook University. I did want to share a call with you guys. We got this call from Tampa, Florida, and we'll get your reaction after.
This is Dakota. Growing up, I was never a man. I liked the indoors, musicals, and being pretty. Yet I was 100% straight. I didn't understand why the men, bullies, thought I was gay. I wish we could live in a world where men didn't have to act like society says a man needs to.
Well, Dakota's comment is something that I think both Pedro and I were talking about earlier, that many men experience masculinity or the traditional definitions of masculinity as a kind of straitjacket. Like, why can't I like musicals? Why can't I like things that are, why can't I have a sense of grace and style without people thinking that I'm not a real man? So here's the thing that I think is interesting. What I think we are looking for, we're all looking for, is a way to expand the possibilities, the range of what is acceptable male behavior, because we're living in a world today where the questions about what gender means, what the gender binary is as it's dissolving, I think that continuum is flattening. People are saying we want to be able to be more expressive on a variety of different dimensions. And I think that that's all really exciting. So, you know, so one sort of facetious comment might be, Dakota, you were born 20 years too early, because it's coming, man.
So I want to throw in a monkey wrench here, because like I mentioned, I am Latina, and I would describe myself as a feminist, and I'm also a heterosexual woman, so that's my intersection. I think that there is a very oppressive machismo within our culture, in this country, very broadly, but there are also things, and maybe I'm defining this incorrectly, there are also things about quote-unquote masculinity that I think are honorable. There's telling me I can't sit in the passenger seat of the car because I'm a girl, and that was something that, you know, I was told when I was a little girl. But there's also this notion of protection, of we're going to take care of you. There's something about being, you know, I guess protected or cared for in a way that I think can be considered traditional masculinity. I'm going to play a call from Roberto and see what get your thoughts on that.
I believe that a male figure should be a provider and a protector to his female partner and his family. I know that this is a very traditional position to hold, but being a 71-year-old, this is what I learned from my father. Even though I hold this position, I do share with my wife all the important decisions that we take, and we are celebrating our 26th year together.
Professor Noguera, your thoughts.
So I certainly understand that sentiment. But what the caller needs to recognize is that increasingly there are lots of men out there who can't find jobs that allow them to provide for their families. And they're experiencing a sense of frustration and defeat because of it. And it's something they don't control. What I would say to him is all people should be able to contribute to themselves, to their households, to their loved ones. All people should accept responsibility for their lives, not just men, women too. And we need to share that responsibility, and we need to work together to figure out how are we going to support each other. We put this burden on men, and very often men feel inadequate when they're unable to contribute to their families. There's a lot of research showing that one of the reasons why many black men, for example, don't marry is when they can't get jobs, because this idea that you don't get married if you're not a provider. We need to rethink the whole role and say, no, everybody needs to contribute. And I think we're better off for it. He did say that he works as a partner with his wife, and they discuss things together. And that, I think, does show evolution. But, you know, the idea that we're going to have a wife staying at home doing the domestic work, that's an outdated idea. In the same way as we want to free women from the limitations of gender, right, the idea that they're the weaker sex, we also want to free men from the limitations of narrow masculinity, and so that we can all be more fully human and experience, you know, love and joy, and as well as pursue the attributes that we all admire, irrespective of gender or race or class.
Pedro Noguera is a sociologist and professor of education at UCLA, and Dr. Michael Kimmel is the founder of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities at Stony Brook University. Thank you both so much for your insights on this today.
What a pleasure. Thanks, Tanzina.
Thanks, Tanzina. It's been great talking to you.
Hi, my name's Timmy from Dallas, Texas. I've always considered myself a fixer. I can fix lots of things. I can fix cars, woodworker, metalworker, but it also includes fixing clothing. I can sew. Wanted to fix a sweater once upon a time, taught myself how to knit. Fix meals for my family. If it ain't right, I taught myself how to fix it. And that's kind of what masculinity is to me.
My name is Victor from San Diego, and I think that men were created fast and large and strong and brave to protect, provide, nurture, lead the family, and stand up to the world on the behalf of their women and children, even at their own expense.
Okay, so we just heard from two academics who've studied masculinity closely. But now we turn to someone with a slightly different set of credentials.
I have none.
That's comedian Michael Ian Black, who you may know from The State, Stella, and lots of shows and movies. Now, Michael may not have a degree in sociology, but he's definitely thought a lot about masculinity, especially in the aftermath of Parkland and other recent mass shootings.
You're not talking to anybody other than a dad of a teenage boy, somebody who spent a lot of time grappling with these issues on his own, and somebody who is doing a fair amount of research on it right now.
Of course, Michael can also draw from his own experiences as a boy.
I was a kid who was, I would say, above average in terms of sensitivity. I was prone to crying a lot. I was a very weepy kid, and I felt things really deeply, as I think most kids do. But I was aware of it enough to, I can recall the exact moment when I shut it down. When I said to myself, I'm no longer allowed to feel this way, because it felt like I was risking too much to do that.
So Michael Ian Black is worried that young boys in the U.S. today, particularly young white boys, are on the wrong path. And the dialogue necessary to change things hasn't even begun.
The first conversation is an acknowledgement that something's wrong. And I don't feel like we're even at that conversation. We're not even there. And so that's the first step, to say there is something wrong. There is something broken in American white boys, whatever it is. And the result of that is that people are dying. And I'm not just talking about mass shootings. I'm talking about suicides. I'm talking about opiate addiction. I'm talking about the declining life expectancy for men and women in this country, but we're confining the conversation to men. There's a terrible problem right now with my gender, or I should say my sex. That's the first step. To acknowledge that is to open an enormous can of worms, because the next question is why. And the answers to that question, I feel like, are really deep. And they don't have any kind of easy solution. They require a multi-generational conversation in the same way that we've spent 50 years talking about women.
Is there a toxic masculinity talk? Or should there be? That fathers or mothers maybe need to have with their sons?
I think there's conversations about consent. I think there's conversations about kindness and respect and civility. I don't think there's a conversation entitled toxic masculinity, particularly that you have with your kids, because I think it opens the door to boys in particular feeling like there is something inherently wrong with them. That's how I felt growing up. I felt like there was something inherently wrong with me, and there was no term toxic masculinity, but I feel like the vision of masculinity that was presented to me was essentially that. It was essentially an idea of toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. And to put that label toxic in front of it, I think ends up doing a bigger disservice. The conversation that we need to have is multifold, and I don't know that it's a verbal conversation primarily. Parenting, in my experience and from my study on the subject, consists primarily of three things. It's a conversation, an ongoing verbal and nonverbal conversation that is primarily rooted in modeling how you behave as an adult around your kids, how you treat other people is the most powerful example. If I say to you, you know, respect women, and then I'm, you know, making a comment to the waitress, right. Mm-hmm. I'm not modeling the behavior that I've set out for my son. You have to model consistently, and that may require, as a parent, you really evaluating your own behavior, and that's not always easy. My wife and I were having this conversation yesterday about an incident that she had on a train where women that she knew were making kind of sexual remarks about a dude, and she was saying that she found that kind of uncomfortable, and she doesn't do that. And I said, honestly, I do. I do have those conversations. I do have those thoughts about women. I don't know that those thoughts will ever go away. I don't know that they should go away. Those are thoughts that I have. But the way they manifest themselves, I have to be conscious and careful of. The same way that I'm conscious and careful of when I'm on your show not to curse, because there's a part of my brain that I can activate to make sure that I'm treating you and your listeners with respect. That's modeling, I think. So that's the first step. The second step is, and this is the more difficult thing, in terms of parenting, because you can't control it. But it's a cultural conversation that has to happen in your community, a community conversation. How do your friends, your kids' friends treat each other? And the peer group component of it is really important. You can't control that. That's why the conversation has to extend beyond you and I. It has to become a broader conversation. It has to become a cultural conversation. How do the peers interact? That's probably as important or more important than how you as a parent model your behavior. And then finally, the largest conversation is the broadest cultural conversation, the media conversation. How are men represented in movies, in television shows, in music? I personally think I don't know if I'm right or wrong about this. I haven't seen any evidence, any compelling evidence that, for example, violent video games cause violence. I don't think that's true. I'm open to the idea. I suspect it's nonsense. But there are sort of paradigmatic ideas that exist in the culture that have an impact. The Marlboro Man had an impact. Mm-hmm. Gary Cooper had an impact. Vin Diesel has an impact, positive or negative. They have an impact. I think it's subtle, and I don't think it's nearly as important as the circles that are closer to us, but I think it exists.
So, on that note, I think women and how far we've come with feminism and sort of our personal growth, a lot of that has to do with the fact that women have been trained to constantly think about their emotions. Part of that is we're open to talking to each other about a lot of this, right? We are open to going to therapy, right, to work these issues through. Men, not so much into therapy. Do men need therapy?
Sure. I don't know that it's realistic to tell some dude working two jobs in Indiana, and by the way, you should go to therapy. I don't know that that's realistic. I do think the model of masculinity that most boys are presented with at a young age is that to share your emotions is to be weak. That's a model that needs to change. To share your own insecurities is to be weak, as opposed to there is strength in empathy. There is courage in expressing your insecurities. There is a bravery in being afraid. Those, I think, are easier messages to digest and hopeful and maybe more helpful messages for boys. And so, you know, that affects the way boys communicate with each other when they're young and as they age. At a certain age, boys are essentially told, shut up. Just shut up. And the way we say it is, be a man. And that's a terrible, terrible message.
Mike Liam Black, thank you for being with us for such a thoughtful conversation.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
That's actor and comedian Mike Liam Black. We sat down a few weeks ago for a Facebook Live discussion where we also talked about allegations against the actor Jeffrey Tambor and so much more. So to find that, visit us on Facebook and we'll have the Facebook Live combo pinned to the top of our show page.
I'm calling from Salem, Oregon. My name is Dean Wachtel. In 1976, I was admitted as the first male RN at UCLA's intensive care unit for newborn babies. And I'm now 83 years old, and what for me is to be a man is what I learned from my babies for 20 years, is to hold the world gently in my hands.
Masculinity in the United States today is, well, complicated. And it's even more complicated if you're a man of color. Just ask Jeanette Powell. She's a woman, but she's raising young Black boys, three of them.
So JJ is my oldest son. He's 8 years old. A sensitive kid, bold personality. He knows he's amazing. Joa is my second child. He is the middle child. I would describe him as a kid who is quiet to most people, but around me, he's pretty fearless and he has a very, very kind heart. And then my youngest son is Jordan. Jordan is three, and when I think about Jordan, I have to take a few deep breaths because Jordan is... he is the baby, and he operates as such. Kind of just, you know, he wants to do his own thing, but he's also a very sweet kid.
Jeanette says that's one of the most challenging parts of bringing up JJ, Joa, and Jordan is navigating that experience with her husband.
You know, I think my husband is an amazing man, but at the same time, you know, we have been socially conditioned a certain way for so long that I think at times he has to catch himself when he is, you know, basically attacking the sensitivity of JJ in a certain sense. I think he has to catch himself. And I think at times I have to catch myself as well because we've been operating under these roles and constraints for so long that sometimes asking the question of why does this bother me or why am I saying this in response to my child's sensitivity, I think has been very important for my husband and I.
Let's talk about some of those roles, particularly for Black men in this country.
Yeah. I mean, for Black men in this country, and, you know, we have a history behind all of this, but this, you know, no emotion. And I mean, you probably hear it outside of just the Black community, but all the comparisons of if you cry, you're a girl. If you show emotion, you're weak, you know, and I think about that so often. And I don't think it's something that I thought about growing up, even though I had brothers. Being a mother now, I see it in a very different way. I feel like there's always that pressure to be tough and to be strong and to be, you know, aggressive and to, you know, stand on your own and to rarely ever show emotion. And so that's been a very difficult thing for me to try to challenge. It's been a difficult thing to try to navigate co-parenting with my husband. But I do think my husband is open. But at the same time, as he is open, we're having to undo so much of the ways that we've been raised, the things that we've seen on TV or in songs or, you know, in books and all of these different things. We're having to undo that and try to parent at the same time.
And like, how do those conversations go between you and your husband when you're sort of figuring out, particularly when it comes to JJ, who's sensitive, like if JJ's crying, for example, what happens then?
Yeah, you know, I'm not always my best. I admit that. I think that as of late, the older that my kids get, I feel like the more I'm kind of protective over allowing them to be who they are and to show it and express emotions. So sometimes I don't handle the conversations with my husband very well. I can just, you know, kind of just like, you know what? Oh my gosh, if you say that, stop acting like a girl, like that really upsets me. And I kind of just lose it, kind of go off a little bit. But I'm aware of that. And I think that what I've been really trying to do is just kind of take a moment, step back, and then have conversations later in the day that say, you know, when JJ was crying and, you know, you talked about that or had a problem with that, this is how it made me feel. And this is why that's a problem. And I think that my husband is a very, very balanced person. He's not the person that gets angry, yells, or any of those things. And he's a very reflective person. So I can see in our last conversation, I can see the reflection there. I can see that he heard what I was saying, how it made me feel when, you know, JJ was having a moment of being emotional. And he said, oh, that was like a girl. He can see how that made me feel and how that was problematic. And I can see the adjustments happening slowly but surely.
12-year-old Tamir Rice was carrying an airsoft pellet gun when he was fatally shot by Cleveland police.
What do we got to do? Will it get worse before it gets better? I mean, we need some help. We need some help down here.
With regular news reports of police brutality against Black boys and Black men, Jeanette is struggling to find a balance between encouraging her kids to be vulnerable without putting them at risk.
This is where it gets difficult for me, because there's this side where you want your Black boys to be emotional. You want them to be able to express their feelings. You want them to be able to operate in what feels most comfortable for them. But sometimes you also realize that showing those emotions comes at a price, and it comes at a cost in this society. And so some of it is operating out of survival. Putting that in context with what we see happening all over the country, especially for black men and Black women, I think that it is a very, very difficult parenting thing for me, because you want to tell your kids about these things, but you don't want them to grow up cold. So there's no perfect way. I feel like I try to preserve their innocence as much as possible, because when they step outside of my home, that innocence is not always given to them. It's not always preserved. But at the same time, I feel like I'm trying to raise very conscious children who know what's happening outside of the home.
And have you started having conversations with your sons about Black masculinity specifically, or about race specifically?
Yeah, they haven't heard the term, right? Black masculinity, but definitely. And so, you know, there are small things that I do that I really try to commit myself to as a parent. And one of those things is, you know, letting my sons know that if at any point they feel like they're being forced to act one way or to hide tears or to not express emotion, to just come to me one-on-one. Right. And I feel like that has been very effective, especially for JJ. He's come to me many, many times. We've had lots of conversations one on one, and it's been very powerful. As far as race, yeah, I've had to have that conversation, especially with my 7-year-old. And I had to have some frank conversations. One day I pulled them in and I said, I'm going to tell you something right now. You know, I said that I wish the world was differently, but as of right now, like, the fact that you're a Black boy matters, and it means something different than the other kids in your classroom. When my kids do something in the classroom, it looks a lot different than when a white child does it in the classroom. And I have to make that very plain and very clear to them, whether I want to or not.
And do you see that impacting your sons at this age in terms of how vulnerable they're allowed to feel and or be in the world?
Yeah. I think it has an impact. But at the same time, I think that there is so much power in parenting, that if we are able to undo many of the things that we learned that were problematic, that we can have the biggest impact in our kids' lives. I think about my father, who wasn't always around in my life very much, because we were living in the time of the war on drugs, and my father was incarcerated for his drug addiction. But I remember the moments that we had together where he would tell me things like, I don't know if you're my daughter or my son, and I love that about you, right? Him standing in the gap, saying those few words to me, made me realize that I didn't have to operate in this traditional gender role of what they say a woman is supposed to be, right? And I feel like I try to do that same thing with my kids, where I try to make it more about, how do I teach them to be good humans? Because I know that if I teach them to be good humans, then they will define what being a man is to them.
And What advice do you have for other parents who are raising black boys right now?
Always ask yourself why. Ask yourself why. When you tell your child, you know, don't cross your leg, or, you know, don't play with that toy, or you can't wear a shirt that is that color, when you have those moments where you feel like you are, you know, going back to these social constructs of what it means to be a boy or what it means to be a girl, ask yourself, where does that come from? Where is it coming from? Because I feel like if we start to dig deep, we can see some of the issues. We can hear some of the things that have been passed down to us from generation to generation. And I feel like when we really get to the root of it, we know that it's a problem, but we've just been conditioned some one way for so long that it takes us to question why we feel the way we feel. What's making us tick in this way? What's making us feel a certain way about something? And I feel like if we do that, then we can get to the root of and the heart of what's really going on, which is this idea of masculinity, and we can be better to our kids. And if we're better to our kids in that way, we can have a better world. I really, really believe that.
Tonette Powell is the mother of three boys, an author, and currently pursuing a PhD in education at UCLA. And Jeanette, I really appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thank you. And to all the families that are listening, you know, love on your boys and love on your girls too. Thanks.
My name is Ryan McKeel, and I am calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I am somebody who identifies as male. I'm a cisgender male, and I often wear skirts, blouses, scarves, and things. Yet, I find that my masculinity is unique to me, and I don't think we can necessarily associate character traits with masculinity, but rather just allowing people to define it as themselves.
Dueling. Again, another three-pointer for Keon Dueling, and the Celtics are 6 of 8 from downtown.
2012 was a great year for NBA player Keon Dueling. He went with the Boston Celtics all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals. After the season was over, the Celtics re-signed him to a $1.4 million contract. But then, during the offseason, everything changed.
So after I signed with the Celtics, I was in Seattle, Washington, doing some charity work. And I go to the restroom, and as I'm using the restroom, a guy feels on me. I felt this rage just in this boom, 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 just kind of brewing within me. And so at that moment, anger took me, and I actually choked the guy who felt on me in that moment. And I'm so thankful that a good friend was there to pull me off of him. And I came back to myself and kind of got out of there and really started suffering from PTSD instantly.
Dueling says he couldn't sleep, he couldn't eat, and ultimately he decided to leave the NBA. The PTSD that Dueling felt was the result of a childhood trauma, one that he had spent his entire life trying to ignore.
I was sexually abused when I was 7 years old, and I didn't share it with anybody. It happened at the hand of a teenage boy, and I think that made me not only angry, but embarrassed, and I decided at a very early age to not tell anybody. And so I went through life navigating, never getting healing, never getting tools, never even talking about my experience, and I carried that throughout my life until the day that I got triggered and I was forced to kind of do my work.
That work? It was something he had never considered before, therapy.
You know, I think men were told to suck it up, be tough, don't cry, don't complain. And, you know, some of those things are just so unnatural. They tell us not to cry, but our first language we speak is crying. If we're not crying, they'll slap us on the butt and make sure we cry because that's a part of what makes us normal. And we have these wonderful things called tear ducts. And so I think a lot of men, we can relate to anger and pleasure. But what I learned in the therapy process is that there are so many emotions in between there that I did not understand. And therapy allowed me to kind of process those things, process what I was feeling, and be able to give me some tools to manage the different emotions as they come.
Before you went to therapy, before you decided to get treatment, had it ever crossed your mind to see a therapist?
No, not at all. I believe that, you know, therapy has a negative stigma. And so in my community in particular, you know, there's words like shrink, head doctor, the crazy house, all those different things. And interesting stat, I think it's less than 6% of black men get therapy. And I believe we come from some of the most, if not the most traumatic experience in this country. And so I didn't understand it. I didn't appreciate it. I didn't value it. And I just never embraced mental health until I went through my own mental health challenges.
And I want to, you mentioned our community. I want to talk a little bit about that specifically, about the unique issues, not just for men and mental health, but men of color, in your case, Black men. In your piece, you wrote that you were channeling all of your rage and anger into sports. And you say, quote, "I had to show everybody that I was strong, that I was an alpha, that I was nobody to mess with." Is that a unique experience to Black men in America, that level upon level of masculinity?
Well, I'm not sure. I can't speak for every other community. I think men across the board are extremely macho and egotistical and territorial. So we butt heads a lot. But, in, you know, unique to our experience in this country, yeah, you have to be tough. You know, a lot of times if you grow up in an area where there's a lot of poverty, you're going to be exposed to a lot of things, and you have to learn how to survive, and you learn survival skills. But those aren't the only things that you learn, but those are some key components that you're able to take with you. And as far as the channeling all my anger, it wasn't just channeled through sports, even though I was able to tap into it. But I also acted out with whether it was drinking or smoking or being promiscuous. And so sometimes the acting out just doesn't come through aggressiveness. Sometimes it comes through hurting yourself and your behaviors.
And I think we see a lot of that, at least historically, with men, right, that are much more aggressive, even when it comes to things like suicide. Until recently, men have been more apt to be more violent, right, in these types of things. So the things that you're describing, acting out, drinking, promiscuity, all of these things seem to be things that men are taught or feel as though that's the only way that they can express their feelings.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. And I want to shift that narrative because I think we're much more than just being, you know, banging on our chest and aggressive. What I've learned is that through the therapy process in particular, you know, I can be more than just a protector. I can be a nurturer. I can be vulnerable. I can be honest. I can be, you know, embarrassed. You know, there's a whole bunch of things we feel or experience, and we don't always have to have aggressive reactions. And so I think, you know, us as men, we have to start doing our work and developing ourselves. I don't think we ever really process our experience. And so there's a lot of baggage that I believe everybody is carrying with them. And if somebody pushes the wrong button, boom, you have an opportunity to be triggered and have an opportunity to explode.
How do you talk about mental health to other men now? I mean, you said it's very important that men, you know, recognize that there are other emotions and go to therapy. But do you have those conversations with the men that you know?
Yes, absolutely. Just recently, you know, this month alone, 10 of my friends or family members or mentees have gone and started their first session of therapy. And so, you know, being able to speak, you know, the language and be vulnerable enough to share my experience with therapy is encouraging to them. And I think we don't see enough examples of men being vulnerable. We celebrate accomplishments, but we don't celebrate the process that it takes in order to become successful. And yeah, I share those conversations and I make them so normal. And it wouldn't work if my life hadn't shifted and they couldn't see change in me. And so those promiscuous behaviors that I had, I don't have them anymore because I worked through them. Those anger issues that I had, well, I'm a little bit more zen now because I probably have already done yoga or meditated before I left the house. And so just useful tools that have helped me, I want to share because I'm living my best life right now. And I want everybody else who might be carrying some baggage to get that opportunity because it feels so good.
And also, I'm wondering how we get past the cultural stigma. I know in Latino families and Latino communities, which my family is, you know, there can be cultural barriers to talking about therapy. Do you find similar barriers if you're talking to someone who happens to be a person of color, a Black man, a Latino man, somebody who might have that added layer?
Yeah, I would say 5 years ago, it was a very difficult conversation. But now I see it shifting. I see that there's a lot of people in my community who understands that, hey, healing is available. Resources are out there and I want to get better. And I think they're starting to do it. And I think the reason why people are so comfortable doing it now is because there's other examples of people being vulnerable enough to share their testimony to help people endure and find their healing. And also, I would say that the lack of resources sometimes in these urban communities is something that doesn't allow people to get the help that they need. And so that's a real thing as well, because my therapy was not cheap.
Now, a significant percentage of people who commit abuse as adults have also been abused as children. And we've mm-hmm. seen this happen with the Junot Diaz story, with the Sherman Alexie story. As a survivor of sexual abuse yourself, how do you feel when you see this coming up, whether it's as an excuse or an explanation for alleged misconduct?
Yeah, no, it hurts, you know. It hurts, you know, to see somebody have to endure with that, because when you go through abuse, you don't come out of it the same. You know, I lost my innocence at 7 years old, and I suffered with anxiety for a great part of my life. I had anger issues. I had promiscuous behaviors. And so you don't get out of it unscathed. Right. I do think that there's a place, you know, this is a great conversation, because I think, you know, people who hurt people and they continue that cycle. And I think that there's a lot of people who have made mistakes who need to get their healing as well. And whether that's the victim or the predator, you know, I just think that there's room for healing and growth and accountability so that we can have a real discussion about sexual abuse, because it's happening in safe havens. It's happening in churches, in families, in schools. It's happening in the workplace. And so if we never talk about it, we can never change it.
What does masculinity mean to you today? And how do you define healthy masculinity?
So today, healthy masculinity to me is being a protector of my family, being a provider of my family, and also being vulnerable enough to love on my family and sensitive enough to share with my family and cry with my family and smile with my family and be goofy with my family. And so that's what masculinity to me is, just being accountable and being a stand up person. What it used to be to me is that I needed to be the dominant figure. I need to dominate by any means necessary. And I don't think that form of masculinity is the one that's going to get us over the top.
Keon Dooling is a former NBA player, and he's also an author and life coach. Keon, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name's Dimitri Boyce. I'm a man, a black man. I've tried therapy, and yes, it helped. You know, men are oftentimes told to hide it. Yeah, suck it up. It is what it is, and we're supposed to deal. But, you know, how do you deal? Most times we aren't taught the tools. I'm glad I went to therapy. And if I hadn't gone to therapy, I wouldn't be the person I am today.
So far, we've mainly talked with and about cisgender men, which is people who identify with the gender assignment they were given at birth. But that's not every man's story. Take Asher Diaz, who was assigned female at birth, but as far back as he can remember, he didn't feel that way.
I would go up to my family and tell them, I'm a boy. And they would look at me very confused and say, what do you mean? You know, I'd been born a girl. They had dressed me as a girl, and I would hide and run from my aunt, who had some traditional beauty standards at the time. And there are pictures of me that we now laugh about where I'm in the corner as a toddler crying in a dress because I didn't want to be in the dress.
When Asher was 24, he began his gender transition. And since then, he's had to answer a lot of questions about his masculinity.
People often ask me, how did you know? How do you know your gender? And I haven't found a great way to articulate it yet. The best way I try to describe it is if you were to wake up in the morning and you couldn't use your senses to either feel or see your body, how would you know your gender?
I spoke with Asher about what being a man has meant in his life, starting with his own family.
For half my family, it wasn't a surprise. I think because I had told them at a young age that I was a boy, and they had seen me playing with my gender or being more masculine presenting in my early 20s after college, that I think things started to click for them. And for some family, I think it was probably a shock. I have an uncle who I grew up with, who also lived with my grandparents, and we're still close, but he's a born-again evangelical, and it was definitely a painful process with him. I think it challenged both of us to continue to love each other, even though we were butting heads about what we thought was right. And, you know, he had told me things like, I believe you're sinning. And it was very hurtful things to hear. And I always say it took about 3 funerals in 8 years for us to come to a place of understanding of, I don't quite understand where you're coming from or even think I agree, but I still love you. And I always say, you know, he's my emergency contact. He's the person if I were ever in trouble, I'd call first. So it was definitely a process and a mixed reaction. And I think in a lot of ways, I was really fortunate. I had a late aunt who actually worked for WNYC, Elaine Rivera. I always say we were kind of the intellectual outcasts of the family, and we got each other. And so she was the first person who actually asked me before I knew. She asked me, do you want to be a man? And I remember at the time I said, you know, I'm just not ready to answer that question. And she respected that. And it was only probably a few months later where I called her and I was like, you know, that question you asked me a few months before, the answer is yes. Like, I want to transition.
And then once you made that transition, how has it felt for you being, if you will, on the other side, now being considered a man in our society? And have you learned things that you probably didn't know before, didn't realize? Are you treated differently?
The short answer, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I have what they call passing privilege. So I passed right away and was perceived as male probably about 3 months into hormone therapy. And now I walk around with a full beard and I've experimented with being out and living stealth and not being out at work and telling people. And I used to have a rule for a few years where I said, I'm only going to tell people if I'm romantically involved with them or I'm at the doctor's on a need-to-know basis. And that was a struggle because at times it felt like I wasn't being my authentic self or I couldn't be honest about my growing up and some of the feminine or female socialization I had had. And there are things that happen, you know, in traditionally male spaces or masculine spaces, such as the barbershop conversations you hear. I think the thing that was most striking for me when our current president said, you know, the things he said on the Access Hollywood tape, all these journalists and all these other men were coming out and say, oh, I never hear conversations like this. And I just kept thinking to myself, what a fool, like they're full of crap. I hear these things all the time now that, you know, what people, men will say when women aren't in the room.
You mentioned being in traditionally masculine or male-dominated spaces. Mm-hmm. And if you are sort of in a situation like that and you hear the locker room talk or you hear, or even worse, you see things that could be considered problematic or the phrase that's now, you know, very popular, toxic, do you feel a responsibility to say something? Do you have to address that? Or is it on a case by case?
I would definitely say it's a case by case. I recently did a technical training program for to pivot in my career to my current role, web development program. And there was one friend I had made who was constantly making these sexist comments. And each day I would try to challenge him on it in a way that wouldn't have him shut down, but that he would hear me. And it got exhausting. I was like, I don't know if I'm doing any good here besides saying, hey, I don't agree with what you're saying. And I'm going to be the one person in the room that says that's not cool. So I try to pick and choose my battles and also assess, like, do I feel safe in this space? How can I approach this? And also try to think about, are trans men held to a different standard than non-trans men? Because we know what this experience is like, or at least I know what this experience is like, navigating the world as a woman for X number of years. Do I have a responsibility to say something? And those are questions I grapple with constantly of when to say something, when to challenge something, given the experience I have and now the privilege that I have.
And the series that we're examining this week is taking a look at masculinity in all of its shape and forms and as many as we can try to get to. The big central question here is, what does it mean to be, quote unquote, a man in the United States in 2018?
Yeah, not to take a out on that. I think that's something I'm still figuring out. Just given this, I would call it unique perspective of knowing what it was like to walk through the world as a woman and being a man now and being in a position where I can really create that something new if I wanted to. And so I was thinking about, you know, who are the male figures in my life? What qualities do they have? How do they, you know, perform their masculinity and what can I take from that? And can there be beauty in that? And I think about, you know, three things. One, being a person of integrity, being kind, and being a person of your word. And those are things that the father figures in my life, growing up with my uncle and my grandfather, and culturally we grew up with, and they still exemplify to this day. And I don't know if those are specific to gender. I think those, you know, can be across gender. And so, not to take another out here, but maybe it's just about being a good human being at the end of the day and walking through the world as a kind person with integrity.
I don't think that's an out at all. I think it's a new way of really approaching this. And there's been so much focus on toxic masculinity. And one of the big questions I had throughout the week is, we talk a lot about the negatives, right? About masculinity and patriarchy and all these really heavy things. But aren't there some positive elements to how we define masculinity or what we consider masculinity?
I'd like to think so. And if not, then I might be in trouble. And I think often when I think about masculinity, I think masculinity doesn't always equal man. It can also be a masculine woman. And what does that mean? Is it performative? Is it how you dress? Is it qualities? Do I identify it with strength? And is there also strength in femininity? And how is that performed? And for me, my constant journey is, and probably will be, how do I perform my masculinity and gender in a way that isn't contributing to the toxicity? Is there ways, elements I can take to create a new masculinity, we will, or maybe one that already exists that isn't harmful?
Asher Diaz is a web developer at UT Austin. Asher, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into masculinity. We really loved hearing your stories about what being a man means to you. And just because the show's over doesn't mean the conversation is. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and share your story. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.